at the end of chapter 5, and we're going to get into chapter 6 at the end of chapter 5, right? We went through what we called the godly line of Seth. As we were going through the godly line of Seth, it was really kind of at the end of chapter 4 where Seth was born. He had a son, called his name Enosh, and at that time people began to call upon the name of the Lord. And we didn't talk about it much there, but calling upon the name of the Lord is prayer, it's relationship, it's walking with the Lord. And they began to do that again. The offspring of Seth began to do that again. And so it's an interesting thing that as we see this line of Seth, we don't get their occupations or their spouses, but we do get every once in a while kind of an indication that they're walking with the Lord. One of the indications was in chapter 5, verse 24, where Enoch walked with God, and then he was not, for God took him. So we have indications that the Lord is being honored, that he's being called upon through this line of Seth. And as we get to...
Is this like, you know, after the, you know, being expelled from the Garden of Eden and all of these, the line of Cain and so forth, mankind has turned away from God and so forth. And this is like they've come back, right?
So
of someone,
yeah, it appears that there is some falling away in the line of Cain. You know, we have, when we were going over through the line of Cain, there were a couple of different things. There was polygamy was in there. There was another murder in there,
right.
Lamech. And so there were different things that were happening in the line of Cain that was an indication of disobedience. And the Bible even talks about the way of Cain, which is the way of Cain in the New Testament. And the way of Cain is a way of disobedience. And so in contrast to that, Seth's line calls upon the name of the Lord. And so don't know exactly kind of from the age standpoint, actually have a timeline here in my Bible, but from a, you know, how much of a gap there was, I think there's a lot of overlap between the two lines of Seth and Cain. But the indication is that the line of Seth is calling upon the name of the Lord. It probably doesn't mean that every single one of them was a believer, you know, following Christ, walking with Christ.
But
generally speaking,
at
that line,
time, people began to call on the name of the Lord.
Correct.
This being the line of Seth, given in the place of Abel.
Of Abel.
Mm-hmm. The amazing thing reading through here is how long these people lived. I'm always amazed at that.
Yeah.
I mean, you got Seth lived 807 years after the birth of Enosh.
Yep. Yeah,
I'm miserable with that.
Sorry.
We talked about the pre-flood lives.
You start wondering about the looks. How did these people health-wise look? I mean, like a pleather?
So we talked about a little bit last week about their diet was probably completely different. And pre-flood, we believe that there was a water canopy above the earth that helped to keep some of the sun's rays, you know, off of them and different things.
Moses was able to walk up a mountain,
across
the valley. His vision was good, you know, and he died strong. But he wasn't
Remember, in the fall, the entire everything begins to spiral, right? And so early on, things aren't spiraling down as bad or as fast. We don't have all the negative genetic mutations, you know, and things of that nature. So,
disease.
Get us to six. Get us to chapter six. Chapter six is interesting. So let's move to chapter six. Thank you for that. We need someone to help us get past chapter five. So at the end of chapter five, just before I get into chapter six, Noah's born. Lamech. Yeah, it's my fault because I do too much recap sometimes. So Lamech is born, and he has Noah. He says that Noah is going to bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. Lamech's almost, a prophetic here that Noah is going to bring peace to us. Noah's name actually means rest. And so we get into chapter 6. And after Noah was 500 years old, Noah, just before, he fathers Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and then chapter 6. And let's get into that. I'm going to read the first few verses out of the ESV. It says, "When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were attractive, and they took as their wives, and they took as their wives, and they chose any they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years." The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. So lots going on here. The first thing that you see is that the world begins increasingly to plummet into corruption. So much so that in verse 3, he says, the Lord says, "My spirit's not going to abide with man forever." And there comes a time where God will no longer associate with sin, that he will judge the people. And so there are a couple of different things happening here. Two distinct lines have been developed, the line of Cain and the line of Seth. And we get to this verse here. Man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them. So there's men and women. There's Seth. There's Cain. There's others as well. And the sons of God saw the daughters of men were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. So
the women
go ahead.
The men?
Uh-huh. Where's the corruption?
Yeah,
it's coming later on in the verse.
Okay.
You're going to see in verse 5, the
yet,
Lord saw that
coming.
There were wickedness
okay.
of men.
Right.
Yeah.
In, sure, in 1 and 2,
not in 1 and 2.
Verse 3, it says that.
Yeah, it says verse 3.
In our version.
Remain with mankind forever because they are corrupt.
In verse 3.
Mm-hmm.
In a different translation, in the Holman Christian.
Should we move back to ESV?
No, that's okay.
Flesh.
Yeah, for he is flesh, and it's the corruption. Is
it?
Remember, so we have the spirit, we have the flesh. And the flesh is often associated with the corruption. So, verse 2 is kind of the controversial verse that everyone's been waiting to talk about. It's the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were attractive, and they took as their wives any that they chose. So the sons of God and has been variously interpreted as angels. Some people have even interpreted it as aliens. And there's been endless speculation also about the Nephilim who've been there. So the first idea here is that man began to multiply. In chapter 1, verse 28, they were asked to multiply. And so at the very beginning here, it's a positive light. It's necessary for God's plan for man to fill the earth.
Commandment.
It was a commandment to be fruitful and multiply. However, in this passage, it reveals that the God-mandated task of multiplying has led eventually to increased wickedness on the earth as the population begins to expand. And so the problem is there's a coming together of the sons of God and the daughters of man, and that kind of introduces us into, when we get to verse 5 and when we get to the next verse, the corruption. Is when the sons of God and the daughters of man come together. And so we really have to know who are these people that we're talking about, right? So the identity really of both groups is uncertain.
Is it two
we're going to do
groups?
A little bit. It's two different groups.
The sons of God and the Nephilim are...
The Nephilim are a different animal altogether. We're going to talk about them in a minute. So the sons of God... So right now we're just talking about the sons of God and the daughters of men. And so again, the identities are uncertain. They're... A bunch of different.
Where does the word Nephilim appear in your
verse? It is in verse 4.
4 in the beginning.
Okay, so mine says there were giants on the earth.
Yes.
That's
and Nephilim is translated often as giants. It's also, we'll get to it in a second, but it's also translated as fallen ones.
Okay.
And so we'll look at that in a second. And that's in verse 4. So the sons of God, the daughters of men, again, the identities of both groups are uncertain. There's been a lot of different solutions advocated for and against. None has necessarily gained universal support, but we're going to go through a few of them. So various scholars have proposed that the sons of God are. So our first option for the sons of God, and this isn't in order of this is the best or what have you, just the first option is that they're fallen angels. Who are the sons of God? Well, the sons of God are fallen angels. You can look at Job chapter 1, verse 6. And in Job chapter 1, verse 6, the sons of God are identified, and they're clearly in that passage, they're clearly angels, are called the sons of God. When you look into the New Testament, there are other references to the sons of God as well. And so, Mark chapter 12, 25 references sons of God. In Mark, the sons of God are angels in heaven, not angels on earth. There are other references that may indicate that these are angelic beings. In 2 Peter chapter 2. Does anyone want to read Job first? Job chapter 1.
How are they fallen angels? Where does that...
Because, and I think part of the reference is when we get to the word Nephilim, Nephilim are fallen ones. And so one of the speculations or the idea is that the copulation between the sons of men and the daughters, the sons of God and the daughters of men resulted in the Nephilim. And if the Nephilim are fallen ones, and so also the sons of God referenced in Job indicates that they're angels.
But my verse says the Nephilim were on the earth.
Exactly. Thank you very much, because that's where I was going to go a little bit later on. I'm telling you, one of the speculations is that the Nephilim are the offspring. I don't believe they are.
Yeah.
And because of what you just said. But you're skipping ahead. We're skipping ahead.
Slow down.
So you're skipping ahead. So we're going to get there in just a second.
I'm just as excited as I am.
I know. So let's go to Job. Job chapter.
Yet he managed to keep his mouth.
Job chapter 1, verse 6.
Job chapter 1, verse 6 says, "There was a day when
So Satan is a fallen angel, and it says the sons of God came to present themselves to the Lord. This is in heaven, and the term sons of God is a reference to angels. And so when we look at sons of God as a reference, there's a reference right there to angels. But let me read Mark chapter 12, verse 25. In the context, Mark's talking about the resurrection in Mark chapter 12. And Jesus says to them in verse 24, "Is this not the reason that you are wrong, because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God?" He's talking to the Sadducees. In verse 25, he says, "For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven." And so Jesus himself says that angels neither marry nor are given in marriage. The people neither marry or are given in marriage, but they're just like the angels of heaven. And so the reference is that Jesus is saying angels aren't marrying and they're not given in marriage.
Okay, so my argument, I have an argument against that.
Okay.
If they're fallen angels, they don't care about
the rules.
They don't care about the rules.
And then,
angels in heaven.
Yeah, so
in their proper position.
And my other thing, too, it's a God's command for him to multiply. Mm-hmm. So people of the earth multiply, and Satan has a way of corrupting God's commands.
Mm-hmm.
And fallen angels do anything they could to corrupt. So my thought, just pose.
Those are good.
Okay. All right.
I don't think we're going to come to a final conclusion here.
So as far as the angels, so in 1 Peter 3, 19 through 20, it says, "In that state he also went and made proclamation to the spirits in prison," verse 20, "who in the past were disobedient when God patiently waited in the days of Noah while an ark was being prepared in a few, that is, eight people were saved through water." If you go to 2 Peter 2,
everybody's just skipping through my Bible study here, but
it
that's
says,
okay.
"For if God didn't spare the angels who sinned," "for if God didn't spare the angels who sinned, but then threw them down into the TARDIS and delivered them to be kept in chains of darkness until judgment."
Can we back up a little bit?
For those? Yeah.
Let's back up a little bit.
I'm just saying.
What's an angel?
It's a spiritual being. Wait, let's stop for just a second. I really do have a lesson, and I'm going to get to almost all of your questions in the context.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Okay?
Got it.
Let me get there, because we keep skipping ahead, and then we're not going to be able to have the continuity in the whole thing.
People have not experienced the previous discussion.
Correct.
So, go, Mark. Go.
So, because I'm going to get
please
there.
Please hold your questions.
Yes. Please hold your questions.
That's 4 years ago.
All right. So, chapter 2 Peter.
You've been chastised.
But that's where I'm going, right? So, 2 Peter chapter 2, For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what's going to happen to the ungodly. So 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4 talks about God not sparing the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell. The question there is, and some people look at that and say, well, the sin of the angels is the copulating with humans from Genesis chapter 6. That's not specified in 2 Peter chapter 2. What it says is, if he didn't spare the angels, who sinned? The sin of the angels was rebellion against God. In the context of chapter 2, he's talking about rebellion against God. Specifically, he's talking about false teachers who've rebelled against God and his message. And now he's relating two different examples in 2 Peter chapter 2. He's relating one example of the angels who sinned, who rebelled against God, and rebelled against the natural state of things of following God in that order. And then he's also referencing the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was also rebellion against God, although there was sexual sin involved in Sodom and Gomorrah. And he's saying that they'll be judged. And what Peter is saying in chapter 2, 2 Peter chapter 2, is that the judgment of God is also going to come upon the false teachers, just like it came upon the angels who sinned and the people in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Are you saying scholars have used that as a reference back to Genesis?
Yeah, when it reads, and here's why, okay. And let me give the other side of the story. So that was one side. The other side says that the angels that sinned is related to the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so they're saying that this is specifically both of those examples in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4 and on are referencing sexual sins. And so they're saying the angels sinned in a sexual way, and Sodom and Gomorrah sinned in a sexual way, and they're being punished. Okay?
But the original sin is the rebellion from the very beginning.
Well, they're two different sides, right? So one side says the angels that sinned, that's a sexual sin. The other side says the angels that sinned is a sin of rebellion. The context of chapter 2 is referencing false prophets, people who have said they're speaking in the name of the Lord, but are using false words to deceive many people. And so there's deception there. So I'm just giving you both sides of the coin on that 2 Peter. And let's turn one more area, and then we'll start to talk about some conclusions that I've drawn, and then we can talk about other people's conclusions as well. Go to Jude, verse 5 and 6, and you're going to see the same sort of reference that we just saw in Peter. Now, I want to remind, chapter 1, now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved people out of the land of Egypt, afterwards destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. And so here again, you get angels in Sodom and Gomorrah in the same reference. And so for the side that believes angels sinned in Genesis chapter 6 and sinned in a sexual way, they point to this verse, or you could point to this verse and say Sodom and Gomorrah, sexual sin, and it's very explicit in verse 7 that they indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desires. And it's referenced here with the angels also who pursued unnatural desires. And so you could say it's the same thing. You know, he's relating Sodom and Gomorrah sexual sin to the sexual sin of angels, of fallen angels. He says these are angels who did not stay within their own position of authority. In this context, Jude is talking about unfaithful people in Israel, and he's also talking about false teachers. Just like 2 Peter is talking about false teachers, Jude here is talking about false teachers, people who've infiltrated the church and who are leading people astray. And so there's a disobedience there. There's the false teaching there. And he's saying they're going to be judged just like the angels and just like Sodom and Gomorrah. And so The one side of the coin says it's a sexual sin. The other side of the coin, just like what I said in 2 Peter, says that the sin of the angels is a sin of not following their created purpose. Their created purpose was to glorify God and to be his messengers. And so it's an unnatural desire for the angels to go against God, just as it was an unnatural desire in Sodom and Gomorrah to have the sexual sin that they had. So two different sides of the coin, and I've also showed you where it says that sons of God in the Bible is sometimes referenced to angels in the Old Testament. However, sons of God is also mentioned in the New Testament and elsewhere in reference to believers as being adopted, as adopted as sons of God, adopted into the family of God. And so let me give you a second option for who the identity of the sons of God are in Genesis chapter 6. So one we've already covered, that would be fallen angels. The second option is they're just tyrannical human judges or kings. They're part of the ungodly line of Cain and Lamech, and they're possibly demon-possessed. And they're called the sons of God because there is a spiritual nature to them, but it's a demonic spiritual nature. These are human judges that are forcibly taking the daughters of men, and some people raping them and different, you know, just having their way with them is the imagery that's given there. So that's kind of a second thing that some people talk about. Not as many people mention them as these tyrannical people, tyrannical judges. The third option that I'm going to give you is that the sons of God are actually followers of God, and they're the male descendants of the godly line of Seth. And so when we've talked about the godly line of Seth, but these are the godly line of Seth who see the ungodly line of Cain and the daughters of Cain, if you will, and take them as their wives. And this would...
They're mortals.
They're mortals, yeah. And this would be... an option that says that it's still a sexual sin. It's still the sons of God that come from the godly line of Seth, seeing the ungodly line of Cain, the daughters of Cain, and almost forcibly taking them as their wives. And what you're going to see, what we know for sure, we don't know for sure who the sons of God are or the daughters of men, but what we know for sure is that the result is corruption and wickedness. We know that for sure. And so the sequence here is that they saw in verse 2 that it was attractive. This is just like the sin of Adam and Eve. Eve saw that the tree was good for food. It was attractive. So she saw it and they took it. And so there it parallels the sequence of the fall. In both cases, it's something good in God's creation that's being used for disobedience, sin, and rebellion against God. And the consequences are tragic. Noah's the only one here, and you can look at the verse that Alan read in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 19, and you can look in 2 Peter. Noah's the only one who stands apart from this sin and stands away from this sin. So the ESV study Bible note says that the identity of both groups is uncertain and that the various solutions have been abdicated, the ones that I've talked about.
The impression I'm getting is that Noah was fiercely militant against this. You would have to be in this corrupt world.
Mm-hmm.
That he would stand apart. That he would clearly be,
Right.
I mean, this is like 1 second after type of thing.
No, exactly.
Mark,
so
there's nothing against the line of Seth and the line of Cain coming together is the way in which, in principle, that theory.
So that's the theory that I adhere to, right? So I believe that the godly line of Seth are the sons of God that saw the daughters of men. They copulated, they had children, and the people who began to call upon the name of the Lord because of this coming together of the ungodly and the godly, they had people or they had children, and they began to fall away from the Lord. And the reason why. Go ahead.
No, sorry.
Finish. Go ahead.
It's because of the lines coming together?
Because
the
of their...
godly and ungodly lines because of the heritage? Or mm-hmm. the way in which they...
Well, because of the heritage and the corruption, right? So even the New Testament talks about being unequally yoked, right? Being yoked, a believer to an unbeliever, right? The idea, spiritually speaking, the idea is that the unbeliever could drag the believer down. In the New Testament, when you see Israelite fighting against the Canaanites, and you see a lot of the things where we say, well, you know, that's genocide or different things, the purpose is that God is trying to purify his people and to keep them separate. Do you follow me? And so there's a real danger, especially in the Old Testament. The enemy is out there. He knows that eventually the seed of Eve is going to crush his head. That's a prophecy that's given to him after the fall, as God pronounces a curse on the serpent, right? So he, from the very beginning, is trying to corrupt that. First through the line of Cain, and now that there's a godly line of Seth, the enemy is trying to corrupt that godly line of Seth. And ultimately, his ultimate goal is to prevent the seed of Eve from even being born. If he could turn everyone away from following God, then there will never be a Jesus Christ.
See, the Eve, meaning Jesus Christ eventually.
Yes.
And through Seth, the forbearance of the line of Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Right.
We talk about he's
the balance.
So,
corrupt the entire line.
Correct. So let me give you my one thing on why I believe that this is the sons of God or the godly line of Seth. Number one, in the New Testament, we can see sons of God being referenced as believers as well. So there are references in the Old Testament, sons of God as angels. There are references in the New Testament and other areas where sons of God are believers or followers of Christ, are people that are following him. That's number one. But the biggest reason that I believe that the sons of God are people is because I don't believe that the Bible shows us anywhere that angels have the physical ability, the physical capability of copulating with humans. They're never seen as being sexual creatures in terms of having the apparatus, if you will, to be able to copulate, the equipment to be able to copulate. Now, they are shown in the New Testament and given masculine identities, but that doesn't mean they're masculine in the way humans are masculine. And so that's number one. The other one is the verse, and you've got a good point, Ivan, that Jesus says that they neither marry nor are given in marriage, right? And Ivan's point is those are the angels in heaven, not the fallen angels, right?
They were having this problem.
Go ahead. Question? Okay, so I didn't mean to stifle questions, just we can ask questions.
Yes, you did.
We got it.
So...
got it.
We are jumping all ahead and chopping it up. So,
asking your text message.
You prepared hard for this.
So,
John needs to put this on his chronological chart.
We'll never completely know who the identity of who are who, but we can get to the Nephilim in just a second because that might help.
So,
go ahead.
When I read this, and I'm no biblical scholar, but to me the angels copulating. To me, the simpler thing is go back to chapter 2, and Adam was made by God, and Eve came out of...
In the image of God.
And Eve came out of Adam. So to me, when I hear sons of God and daughters of men, I think about a parallel to just chapter 2 with Adam and Eve. That's number one. Number two is the flood follows this very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The flood kills mortal men. It's not going to... you don't flood angels, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
So the flood, angels would be... So if the problem is the corruption of man, then flood is the cure for that. I don't see angels as part of the equation.
Because angels would have to be... But then you could say that in the New Testament that he did confine those angels who sinned. That could be the other argument, that he confined the angels that sinned in chains and darkness.
Yeah.
But the flood wasn't the chains and darkness, yeah.
So the other, that's kind of my narrow point. The broader part that we don't need to spend a lot of time on, but to me is why we're doing, well, part of why I'm doing this, is there's sort of a journey. There's wicked. Man has inherent flaws.
Mm-hmm.
So what I don't get the sense that God affects man. In other words, is Noah's offspring, or are Noah's offspring fundamentally less evil than Enoch and
Lamech and
it's not clear to me that they are, because when we have this pattern, we have expulsion from the garden, we have a flood. In the time of Moses, we have, you know, the golden calf, and it seems like, you know, this is all sort of a preamble to the articulation of law as a necessary set boundary condition to constrain the inherent wickedness of man and allow these chosen people to prosper, which then creates the realm in which Christ can come into. But it feels like it's a little bit of a trial. I mean, it's hard to say this, but God's doing a little trial and error here in the early chapter.
I think
Genesis is, you know, until we evolve.
I think you look at it as a process, right? He's created man, and now the processes that are going to result in the coming of Christ and the redemption of man through the atonement is everything in the Old Testament is leading to that.
Right.
It's the ultimate, you know, conclusion, or really the beginning, really, for us as Christians as well. Other questions? Now we can ask questions.
Process being because the way you stated is trial and error tends to suggest that God's not exactly
didn't know
sure
what he was doing.
What's going to be best, and so he's kind of working on it as he goes.
So I would
as
say,
as opposed to being, you know,
it's a process.
So
knowing
he had a plan
is
from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
God
obviously
would know already what
sure
the end is.
Sure, but it's a process too for man to develop to the understanding of the need, for the law, which shows them their sin, which shows them their need. Do you follow? And so all of these steps are being taken from Genesis, and we're learning and we're understanding and we're growing as people in our understanding of our need, understanding of our corruption, understanding of God's perfection and his judgment and his will.
Yeah, so that mankind would be prepared for
the Savior
of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just process is put in place so
correct
that the time would be right, and that's what you're saying.
I think that one way to read this early part of 6 is that as a population gets big enough, that competition for wives has the inherent potential for corruption.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of this reset button, let's get to a smaller number of people, but we see this as a theme repeatedly in the Old Testament.
I love some of this.
And, you know, Bathsheba, I mean, you know, there's this theme of the inherent corruptibility of.
And it's not.
It's the dark side of be fruitful and multiply.
And it's not going to go away even after the flood, right?
Right.
So we're going to have the flood. We all know, you know, spoiler alert, we know what happens, right? But, except for Van, apparently, with that look. After the flood, God pronounces, I'm never going to do this again. And he says, I'm never going to do this again, even though man's heart is continually wicked. And so there's a recognition by God, even after the flood, that things don't get better, right? Things are going to continue to get bad. There's going to continue to be corruption on the earth. He says, I'm not going to destroy it this way again, even though their hearts are continuing. So you see the grace of God working even after, during the flood for Noah and his family, but even after the flood, the grace of God is abundant. It's part of his nature. It's part of who he is. And it's part of how he deals with us, which thank God, literally, that he deals with us with grace and mercy and not always judgment. Here in chapter 6, you're going to see judgment, right, for a purpose. And again, I think it's part of the process.
So I would postulate that the reason for the reset on the flood reset is this injection of the angelic hosts having procreated humans, creating such a situation on earth of rampant evil that had gone beyond
imagining
what's imaginable, right? Literally, their imaginations were quite literally evil all the time, and there's just no way to redeem this situation, right? God had foreseen all of that anyway. the reset at the flood brings it back to a smaller group of people. And it also, at the same time, as we've read, he took out...
He changed those angels.
He took out the problem.
Yeah, he took out the Nephilim.
The fallen angels. So that another reset...
It couldn't happen again.
...would not be necessary.
So you're saying that angels copulated with men before the flood, but can't do it after the flood because they're in chains now.
Because now they're in chains.
But questions would arise about a New Testament demon possession, for example. Those are still fallen angels. Does that mean that angels could still fall? Are they still fallen today? Why aren't those angels chained? Why aren't those angels put away in darkness?
I think the comprehension of all the angels that are... because angels are aware of what happened. Mm-hmm.
They're no dummies.
They're no dummies. They know if they cross that line from that point forward, where you go,
that they'll be in chains.
It's not a great place.
So not all of them are in chains. Only the ones that sin this way are in chains. And that, I mean, that I think that is, and there are a lot of intelligent people that believe that that's a good way, that's a reasonable assumption. I'm not swayed by it because I don't think that the angels can physically copulate with humans. You never see in the Bible. An angel, a fallen angel, manifesting as a human. Now you do see companions with what we believe is a pre-incarnate Jesus Christ in the Old Testament a couple of times. Christophanies, what it's called when Christ, a pre-incarnate Christ, is physically visible to people in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, sorry. And there are angels as well. Sodom and Gomorrah, the men wanted to get to the angels that have sex with the angels. And so they believe, again, I believe that the angels, and those are not fallen angels, but I believe that the angels are presented as masculine. Again, I don't believe that they have the physical ability to copulate. Now, I'll give you this. The second option was that these were tyrannical men that copulated with the daughters of women. And I do believe that if that's a possibility and that this seed got corrupted through a spiritual means, that it could be that the angels chained in darkness physically possessed people and then in that way were able to copulate with mankind. But I don't believe they could do that in and of themselves because I don't think they have the physical capability of being able to do that.
Could I ask
so they could have possessed a man, and that man could have raped a woman, and they could have had corrupt seed from that union. But I don't believe that an angel could have done that on their own. Go ahead.
I mean, a blunt question, whether you believe in version 1, 2, or 3.
Doesn't matter.
Does that change the it outcome doesn't change of the any outcome. Of this later on? I mean, because part of the big message you're taking away that there was sin,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And because of that sin, the action, the cause and effect was that
it's really a rabbit trail.
Mandated.
Yeah,
and does it have any repercussions further?
It does not.
Jesus,
I don't believe it does. Message? No,
I'm so angry, I'm leaving. What? That doesn't cause
it. It doesn't. It doesn't change the outcome. Right. Can I get to the outcome? We can talk a little bit.
Yes.
Let me. So the next verse. Let's look at the next verse here. Verse 4. Well, actually, verse 3. My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. Not spirit, but he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. That actual 120 years is referencing to the flood. He's going to set a timeline, and he's going to give 120 years until he's going to destroy man. And so the verse 4 is, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and afterwards. To Van's point, the Nephilim were there before and after the copulation of the men and the sons and the daughters of the sons of God and the daughters of Eve. And so I believe that the Nephilim were people that were there both before and after, and not necessarily the result.
They're not the same descendants.
And not necessarily the result of the union of man and women. Say again.
Difficulty with that is why it's mentioned.
I think it's mentioned as a reference point, a reference point to the time and the time that the author is referring to, is that the Nephilim were there. It doesn't result necessarily from the union. It does look like they're present before, because it says before, in those days and also afterwards. But here's the other thing.
Right.
The meaning of the term Nephilim is uncertain. Okay, it does occur other times in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. In Numbers chapter 13, verse 33, it denotes a people that are living in Canaan, and that's after the flood. Mm-hmm. And so, if both passages refer to the same people, the Israelite spies are seeing these people, and they're expressing their fears that the Canaanites are like the ancient men of renown. And they're saying, the Israelites are saying that these are giants. And so the name Nephilim has two possibilities. In Hebrew, the name Nephilim, which is very similar, it means fallen ones. But the earliest Greek translators rendered that name giants. And so the question is, are these giants, or are these fallen ones, or are they the same? We know that the next verse says that these were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. So the Nephilim were mighty men, which probably means they were warriors, and may well have contributed to the violence that was occurring in the world at that time.
And that's what kind of my commentary kind of speculates, that the reason they made this allusion was because the Nephilim of ancient days were
like the Canaanites,
reputation for violence,
and very similar to the Canaanites, which is why the spies, when they see the Canaanites, they say they're big, they're violent, they're bad, they're bad folks, right?
So once you introduce DNA into a population, it has a tendency to go dormant and then replicate itself at other times. So the fact that you have Nephilim post flood just means that of the eight people that were on the ark,
some of them were infected with fallen angel blood,
Nephilim DNA.
Well, if they're pre-flood and they're still alive post-flood, then there you go.
Yeah,
Mark.
Huh?
Did they say life was
Nephilim? So it's DNA. So
there is a Goliath.
So he's a giant. So yeah. So see, I would say that our DNA doesn't make us wicked or not.
No.
So you said that they were corrupted with angel DNA. So
no, you didn't say that.
No,
I thought that's what you said.
No, you said that.
Nephilim DNA, but Nephilim DNA
is introduced into the population by the copulation, the angels.
Man.
Oh, and you're saying that they're.
And I say it just gets carried forward in the people who
but
were in the
ark. He's basically saying the people before the flood and after flood, which were the eight people, one of them was.
You're talking about the gene that produced a Nephilim, a giant.
Yeah,
I can see that. But are you saying that that's? But I think that you're.
I'm not suggesting that the gene itself is part of the corruption.
Right, you're saying that it's what's created them giants.
Is not from literally the physical flesh.
That's what I wanted to be clear on, because I was unclear.
He didn't say that at all. He was just saying that it carried over because someone of the eight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, all humankind is corrupt from the perspective that we.
But your take.
That's not a DNA.
Your take
thing,
though is your take. I think your take is that the Nephilim are the offspring of.
Might be definitely it.
And you believe that they are the offspring of demons and women.
Yeah.
They are the outcome.
The offspring.
Right. They are the outcome of that union. That the reason why it's mentioned in this passage here is it's an extraordinary outcome, and that's why it's brought up. The reason why it was bad that men and women, or angels and human women, copulated, is that it created beings that were not intended, these giants, right? And because of the presence of these giants, they have, just because of their physical capabilities, it puts them at an advantage over the rest of humanity that leads them down the path of, you know, like Goliath, where they, because of their physical prowess, they become arrogant and become violent, and they take over things, right?
And my sin is 70 times 7.
I definitely think the Nephilim are probably giants. They're probably large-statured and warrior-like people. My take is a little different than Ivan's, and we've been having this for years, and so he's not going to convince me, but I don't think that's the result of the union. I think that they're there, and they're contributing to the violence of that world. What I believe is that they're the godly line copulating with an ungodly line, and it's a reference to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness, or what fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? Or what portion does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. And so 2 Corinthians says, don't be unequally yoked. And I think that's what's happening here, whether it's angels and people, or whether it's godly line or ungodly line. As Victor said, the result is corruption. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the corruption that comes grieves God to his heart. In verse 5, it says that the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continuously. And so that's the verse that really should break our hearts. Because what ends up happening is there that the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And I hate to do this, but I'm going to say one other reason why I believe that this is just men and women and not angels is, if we do have the angels, and I'll let you retort, you can retort on that. If we do have the angels copulating with women, and then they're chained up, never for that to happen again, then this type of corruption can't happen again. Because it's so bad, as you mentioned, it's so wicked, it's so crazy, that God has to destroy the earth.
Right.
I think that this type of corruption can happen again, because it's man and man and not man and angels. And I think that the ability for us to get back to a chapter 6, verse 5, where the Lord sees that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intention of the hearts and their minds was evil continuously, is still a possibility on the earth.
It has to be a possibility, right?
And I think that that's what leads us to the ultimate judgment in the book of Revelation.
Yeah. Obviously, not to the extent that occurred during that time.
The world as we know it will be destroyed again.
The world will be destroyed again.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
Why do you say obviously?
Well, because he did it then. There's a reason why we had a flood.
Right.
But he's going to do it again.
But he's going to do
it again. He's going to destroy it again. But when he does that, it's because he pulls the spirit, his spirit out of the world. And
So the point being is there. His spirit will remain in the world until that time.
See, that's part of where you and I come in different circles, because even my end time philosophy or my end time beliefs are different. Eschatology, because I don't believe he pulls the spirit out of the world either. So that's where it's consistent. I disagree, but we can have that argument later.
Paul says, we know what's restraining.
Yeah, and I don't believe the restrainer is the Holy Spirit. But we can talk about that later. It's a whole different argument. In my eschatology, the restrainer is not the Holy Spirit. But again, that's a whole other... At least I think you're consistent, and I think I'm consistent in that. So,
why do they keep going back to Sodom and Gomorrah?
Yeah, and in both cases in the New Testament, they're specifically talking about false teachers who are corrupting the natural gospel message, right? So there's the gospel message, they're corrupting that, and the Sodom and Gomorrah was an unnatural sin going after. Were angels what?
Were angels involved in Sodom and Gomorrah? Fallen angels? Were they
there?
Sin went there? Was it a resurgence?
There may have been demonic influence in Sodom and Gomorrah. So there's probably demonic influence in Sodom and Gomorrah.
But smoke was still going.
Yeah. Interesting.
It was 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. So, again, verse 5, the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that the intention and the thoughts of his heart were evil only continually. Mm-hmm. That should grieve us to our hearts as well.
So the 120 years, that's how long, that's when God said it's coming, the flood's coming?
Correct.
Not how long man will live.
No. It's 120 years from this point that you're going to see that Noah's going to be... Noah's going to be building the ark for that long. And you're going to, and it says, let me read verse 6 and then we'll be done. And the Lord was sorry.
In the Jewish Bible I'm reading here, it says that, therefore their lifespan is to be 120. So that's the way they interpret it.
Yeah.
That's how I was talking.
And that is the second. So there's the lifespan or the Noah, but you're going to see that Noah's building his ark for that long. And they do live different age. They don't live 120 years after the ark. And so the Lord, verse 6, and the Lord was sorry that he had made man on earth, and it grieved him to his heart. I'm going to leave it there. We'll pick up 5 and 6 next week, and we'll go over those.
Wow, that's a way to end it.
Yeah, grieved him to his heart, and he was sorry that he made man. So our question could be, did he make a mistake? Said he's sorry that he made man. He wished he didn't do it. We can talk about that next week. That's a cliffhanger to tease.